This podcast is a part of Sphera,
a collective of independent media outlets from across Europe.
For more information,
visit sphera-hub.com.
Katie, I feel like the world is throwing us quite a lot of apocalyptic 2020 energy right now.
Woohoo! The old times are back.
Yeah, and it feels a bit too soon to feel like nostalgic about that period. But we can make a podcast about Europe without mentioning any letters of the Greek alphabet. Poor Greek alphabet, by the way, being used like this.
I mean, it's nice that we're all getting to grips with it. It's, you know, a nice revival of ancient culture, I suppose you could say.
Except they keep missing out loads of letters in the alphabet, so it's really not helping my education.
Oh.
Anyway, I think this week, more than usual, we could all do with talking about some other things, don't you?
I do. So what are we actually talking about?
Well, we've got a nice, diverting interview for you today. Katie and I love TV.
You may have noticed.
And as we've discussed before on the show, a lot of us are watching more and more TV and films in foreign languages. Something that could be said to be bringing us together and helping us share and understand each other's cultures. And the accessibility of foreign language shows is thanks to a group of wonderful professionals who spend their days with the pretty challenging job of translating, subtitling these shows so that we can understand what we otherwise wouldn't. And in recent weeks, there have been a few controversies online around some subpar subtitling of specific shows, which we'll talk about later. But this week, we decided we wanted to speak to a professional subtitler. So we'll be calling up Max Deryagin, a Russian subtitler and chair of SUTTLE, the Subtitlers Association, a group that is trying to ensure that subtitling is acknowledged as an essential art form.
But first, who's had a good week, Dominic?
Well, it was a good week last week, really, for Olaf Scholz, the Social Democrat leader and current Vice Chancellor of Germany, who is now on course to succeed Angela Merkel as the next Chancellor of Germany after he released details of a coalition agreement with the leaders of the Green Party and the Free Democratic Party. It's a so-called traffic light coalition, thanks to the green, yellow and red colours of those parties. As is German tradition, the coalition agreement goes into quite a bit of detail, over 170 pages of detail, in fact, which, as Tom Nuttall pointed out on Twitter, is just a bit longer than The Great Gatsby, but I'm sure it's just as gripping.
What a specific reference. Also, it seems crazy to me that, like, plans for a government would be fleshed out in such great detail. It's kind of amazing.
Yes, it is. I have to admit, I obviously didn't read all 170 pages myself. My German is not good enough.
Dominic.
I will try and give you a good summary of what is in it anyway. It's got a subheading of Dare More Progress, which I'm sure works much better in German than awkwardly translated like this. It's referencing the motto of Willy Brandt, who was the first German chancellor from the Social Democratic Party. His motto was Dare More Democracy. And the coalition described themselves as an alliance of freedom, justice, and sustainability. And I think they've done a pretty good job at presenting a unified front in announcing this coalition. But if you lift up the bonnet of this agreement, you'll see quite a bit of vagary amidst all these tens of thousands of words. Some convenient ambiguity, you could say, perhaps in order to paper over some of the pretty enormous differences between the three parties.
Mm.
And the main political gap to bridge for this agreement was between the free market loving and low tax and spend party, the Free Democrats, and the other two parties who are more left-wing economically and inclined to spend money to fix things. I actually saw this incredible graphic in the run-up to the German election showing the differences in tax and spending policies between all the parties that were running. And the FDP were quite extreme in how much they wanted to shrink the size of state spending, way more than Merkel's Christian Democrats, who, of course, didn't win the election and aren't involved in this new coalition.
But were previously in government with the Social Democrats, right? So they, in a weird way, were a sort of less complicated pair to have in government together.
Yeah, in some ways they could have been. In other ways, not so much. We'll get to that later. There are some areas in which the FDP and the SPD agree. But yeah, there was this big bridge to gap. And it's not totally clear how this fiscal gap is going to be bridged in reality, especially because some of the policies they've proposed seem pretty expensive. Things like massive investment in Germany's railway infrastructure and a digital transformation of the economy. And the parties seem to have agreed to some pretty tough fiscal rules that were presumably demanded by this Liberal Party. They've said, for example, that they won't raise taxes, and they've agreed to reintroduce this debt brake mechanism from 2023, which stops the country from taking on new debt. The other big win for the FDP is that their party leader is being put in charge of the purse strings. He is going to take over the finance ministry.
Okay, so it sounds like the FDP have quite a lot to be happy with when it comes to the control they've got over the budget. The other smaller party in this coalition is the Greens. What have they got to be happy about?
Well, I think they'll be pretty pleased with the fact that they got the other parties to agree to phasing out coal power in Germany 8 years earlier than currently planned, so in 2030 instead of 2038. Hmm. They will also be pleased with the pledge for 15 million electric vehicles on German roads by 2030, although environmentalists were a bit disappointed that there wasn't a clear date decided for the end of all petrol and diesel cars. There is also a commitment to provide 80% of Germany's energy from renewable sources by 2030. So some big goals that aren't entirely satisfying environmentalists, but it's good to remember that over the last decade or so, Germany have been pretty sluggish in their energy transition compared to other big European countries. So these plans are definitely an improvement and something that the Greens can shout about as victory, I think.
And what about the Social Democrats themselves, the big guns in all this?
Yeah, well, they won the election after all. And because of that, they are getting the chancellorship if the coalition agreement sticks. And Olaf Scholz will be stepping into that top job. The party also are getting the health, interior and defense ministries. And in terms of policy, I think they'll be pleased to have secured a raise in the minimum wage to 12 euros an hour, something that is thought will benefit around 10 million Germans. The agreement also plans to build 400,000 apartments per year to help solve the housing crisis, though some SPD supporters will be disappointed that there's no mention of extending rent controls, probably because it was a policy that the FDP had like completely ruled out. But as I said earlier, there are some policy areas that I think all three parties will be happy with. There are a few progressive policies which they seem to agree on. I think it's fair to say that all three parties are happy with the plan to legalize the selling of cannabis for recreational use from licensed shops, which is quite a big development.
Yeah.
Perhaps there'll be fewer German tourists in Amsterdam as a result.
It's one knock-on effect.
All the parties are also behind lowering the voting age to 16, perhaps in part due to the fact that they all hope to benefit electorally from this younger age group being allowed to vote. That's my cynical side coming out. They are also planning on improving LGBT rights, and they also want to get rid of a Nazi-era law that bans any advertising or publicity about abortions. Extraordinary that that still exists.
I always forget that's the case in Germany. It seems so outdated. It's crazy.
Yeah, well, hopefully that will be gone soon. And they're going to update and ease the rules about gaining German citizenship, meaning that residents can apply after 3 years for citizenship and also keep their other nationalities. So it's fair to say that put together, this agreement signals quite a big change for Germany, even if Scholz managed to position himself during the election as the Merkel continuity candidate. And perhaps he will appear on the European and global stage more or less like a continuity chancellor after Merkel. But within the country, this document signals that there are quite some changes coming.
And so what actually happens now? Like, when is Scholz coming in as chancellor, in theory?
Well, first, the deal needs to be approved by all three parties, which is perhaps why there is a bit of vagueness and a few optimistic proposals on the finance side of things. All the party leaders need to be able to sell this agreement to their base, including the financially conservative party of the FDP. If the deal is approved by all three parties, then the Bundestag, the German parliament, will probably elect Scholz as chancellor in mid-December. They're hoping that it'll be before Christmas so he can give the big end-of-year speech.
Is he going to have Merkel's shiny jacket on?
Oh, we'll have to see about whether he meets Merkel's fashion game. I'm not sure he will.
I'm going to miss those jackets so much.
Yeah, something else I'm going to miss, Katie, is our temporary logo.
Yeah.
You may have noticed that a few months back, Eddie Stock, the wonderful creative director of Are We Europe, pimped our podcast logo with some beautiful lorikeet parrots in tribute to Merkel's viral parrot moment that happened a few months ago. We promised that we'd only keep this logo until Germany have a new coalition. And so sadly, we may have to get rid of it quite soon.
We did actually debate just keeping it because we really like the lorikeets. But much like the new German coalition, I think we should keep our promises, Dominic.
I'm not sure. I think we should do a poll on Instagram stories and let the public decide. Dare more democracy.
Dare more democracy.
Who's had a bad week, Katie?
Well, it's been a terrible week in the English Channel. As you will no doubt have seen by now, 27 people lost their lives last week while trying to cross from France to the UK in a very unseaworthy boat. All of these lives cut brutally short in what must have been terrifying circumstances. It's still not really clear what happened, but there have been some reports that this little boat was hit by a container ship, which sadly wouldn't be that surprising because this is one of the busiest shipping lanes in the world. Hundreds of boats pass through it every day, including these really big ships. It's really an incredibly dangerous crossing.
I think sometimes we like underestimate the danger of crossing the channel because people swim it sometimes. In the British consciousness anyway, it's thought of as a really short distance, but it's still really dangerous.
Yeah, right. And the people smugglers who organise these crossings, they tell people, you know, don't worry, you're basically crossing a lake. But it's more like a motorway. You've got all of these massive ships. They can't always see these little dinghies. And the waves can be really big, like 2 meters high. The water's also really cold now. So if you fall in, even if you've got a life jacket, you could really easily catch hypothermia.
And is this a like fairly new thing with people trying to get to the UK by boat? Or is it just getting media attention now?
Well, it has been happening increasingly since about 2018. But people have been trying to reach the UK for decades, at least since the war in Bosnia in the 90s. Previously, people would mostly try to sneak into the back of lorries that were taking the tunnel under the channel. And there used to be this huge camp, you might remember it, it was called the Jungle in Calais on the French coast, where people sometimes lived for years while trying, like night after night, to jump onto these trucks. But yeah, in recent years, the French authorities have got much better at stopping that from happening. And that is one of the factors that has driven this increase in people trying to get across by sea. More than 25,000 people have made it this year, which is really quite a big increase on last year when it was just 8,500 people.
It feels to me from the reporting that whilst some politicians are acknowledging the tragedy of what happened, they are also like immediately going to finger pointing and blaming each other.
Yeah, and it's been pretty ugly. Not a great time to be both British and French. I don't think either of my governments has dealt with this that well. At one point this week, we saw France uninvite the British Home Secretary, Priti Patel, from a meeting. And France did that because it was like mad at Boris Johnson for tweeting this letter that he wrote to Emmanuel Macron about this accident before Macron had even received it, which just felt like, you know, like people are dead here. Like, I really don't care about petty nonsense over tweets. Can we just find a solution to this? On the British side, especially, there's been a lot of ugliness in terms of people suggesting even that France is behaving a bit like Belarus here and like deliberately sending asylum seekers to the UK as part of some kind of punishment for Brexit, which is a bit of an unhinged suggestion, frankly. To me, it seems quite distasteful, given what has just happened, that a lot of British politicians especially have used this tragedy to try to score some political points, even if it doesn't go quite as far as these loopy comparisons to Belarus. You have had a lot of UK politicians and the pro-government right-wing press saying, you know, this is all France's fault. How dare they do so little to stop these people from coming? personally, I'm really deeply uncomfortable with that kind of rhetoric because I find it really dehumanizing of the people making this journey. It makes them sound like some kind of threat to the British nation rather than people fleeing war and persecution. But even if you don't agree with that view of things, this idea that France has just stood aside and willingly watched this happen, it's pretty far from the truth. France says it's currently managing to stop about 60% of these boats from taking off. So the numbers would be much higher if they weren't doing that. And we're talking about a stretch of coast that's like 300 kilometers long, nearly. It's impossible to patrol the whole thing at once. And the people smugglers, they're really good at tracking the police's movements so that they can launch the boats at a moment when the police aren't around. But Britain is saying, you know, this isn't good enough. We've given the French government tens of millions of pounds to stop these boats so that we don't have to think about this problem. And France is saying, well, yes, you have, but the resources that we have just aren't even close enough to being enough to stop all of these boats from leaving.
So we made an episode about pushbacks a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering, is that something that's happening here?
Right. So just a quick recap. If you turn up on a country's territory and you say, I want to claim asylum, that country is supposed to go through your application and assess it, even if they eventually say no. So this is like a really important principle of international law that came out of World War II when so many Jewish people got pushed back at borders. The channel is divided between a French side and a British side. And if the French Coast Guard are on patrol within their own waters and they see a boat full of refugees, it wouldn't be illegal for them to take those people back to France. But if the passengers have crossed the line to the UK side of the water and they say, we want to claim asylum in the UK, they should be taken to UK soil so that their application claim can be processed. And that is what's been happening a lot over the past few months. British lifeboats have been picking these people up, or sometimes it's the border guards. Sometimes the boats make it all the way themselves to the beach in England. However, Boris Johnson wrote to Emmanuel Macron this week, this controversial letter that he tweeted. And among the things that he asked for was, and I quote, all illegal migrants who cross the channel to be returned. Now, leaving aside this decision to call these people illegal migrants, which again makes them sound kind of threatening, what he's asking for is for systematic pushbacks. Remember, these are people who want to claim asylum in the UK, and they want it really desperately. That's why they've decided to make this horrifically risky journey. And Boris Johnson wants to say, well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I don't really care where you want to claim asylum. You've arrived here from a safe country, aka France. So you should just claim asylum there, not our problem.
What do you make of this argument that these people are trying to set off from a safe country?
Well, you know, there's no actual law that says people should and must claim asylum in the first safe country where they arrive if they're fleeing from a war. We do have this Dublin regulation in the EU, which says that people should claim asylum in the first EU country that they enter. But Britain isn't in the EU, as you may remember. And the thing that also frustrates me about this argument is that it doesn't really show much understanding of the people making this journey. I haven't been to Calais that recently, but the last time I was there a few years ago, you know, I would ask everyone in the camp, like, why don't you just claim asylum here? France is a pretty good country. It's safe. It's got a good economy. And most people would say, oh, I've already got family in the UK. I am trying to join my sister or my fiance or my uncle. A lot of people would also mention language and the fact that they already spoke pretty good English, so hopefully it would be easier to work or study in the UK. And I do want to be honest and say some people I spoke to did have quite unrealistic and romantic ideas about like just how great life is in Britain and how amazing it would be if they could just make it there, which I think sometimes was like a coping mechanism. You know, when you're living in such terrible conditions in like camps in the woods, you have to believe that there's something better coming. But yeah, if you think about the people who are attempting this journey, they are just desperate to get to the UK specifically, usually for personal reasons, like trying to reach their family. It's a crazy extra ordeal to put yourself through if you have already made it all the way through Europe to France to actually do this. And I think that's reflected in the numbers. In Germany last year, about 120,000 people claimed asylum. In France, it was 93,000. But in the UK, it was only 36,000. Most people who make it to Europe, they stop somewhere along the way. And a lot of critics of the UK government have pointed out that in proportion to the size of the country and the size of the economy, the UK hasn't really offered asylum to that many people. And there's a lot of charities and rights groups saying, you know, this is one of the big reasons that people are making this dangerous journey. It's because of just how hard the UK makes it to get there legally. The first victim to be named after last week's terrible tragedy was a young woman called Mariam Nouri Mohammed Amin. She was Kurdish, like a lot of other people on that boat, and she was trying to reach her fiancé, who was already in the UK. But even if you're already married, it can be really, really difficult to actually convince the British authorities to let you get on a plane and get there legally. Mariam had tried legally twice already, and she felt like getting to the UK this way was the only way left if she wanted to see her fiancé again. And it went terribly, terribly wrong. France has suggested that one way to make it safer would be for the UK government to process people's asylum claims on this side of the channel so that they could then travel to Britain legally. But I honestly don't think that anything like that is remotely on the UK's agenda right now. It does not want to actively welcome asylum seekers or do anything that looks like, you know, encouraging people to come to the UK. It really doesn't fit with this whole take back control, protect the island, fortress kind of psychology that has been so, so reinforced by Brexit. I think probably the best that we can hope for is that politicians on both sides of the channel can work together to clamp down on people smuggling, which there is some willingness to do, even though there is a load of bad blood between France and the UK right now. But I don't think they'll ever dissuade people altogether from trying to make this journey, however dangerous and exploitative it is.
Yeah, it's just a really, really bleak situation. It seems like there's a lot of humanity missing in the way that at least the UK government are responding to it. Not a proud time to be British.
On a much brighter note, we have a new supporter to thank. Madeline Savitt, take a bow.
Thank you, Madeline. We are so grateful to our wonderful supporters on Patreon who donate a bit of money each month to help us cover our costs and pay the people we work with. Making podcasts is surprisingly time-consuming and labor-intensive, but we love doing it and love that so many of you are willing to help us keep going with a bit of financial support. You can join Madeline and our other lovely supporters by heading to patreon.com/Europeans podcast to find out what we can offer you if you become a supporter. It's not much, to be honest, but it's charming.
Spoiler alert.
And it's a great Christmas present for a friend who likes this podcast.
Oh, you can
pay the whole year's subscription in one go with a bit of a discount. So head over to patreon.com and come join the club.
I like this idea of sponsoring us as a Christmas present for someone else. It makes me feel like we're one of those like sponsored donkeys that you can buy for a child at like an animal sanctuary.
I like to think of myself as more of a parrot.
Sponsored parrot, there you go. We at the Europeans have spent a lot of this pandemic watching international television. And we're not alone. There have been massive international hits over the past couple of years, largely thanks to a certain streaming giant called Netflix, series like Money Heist and Lupin. And as a result of that, the idea of watching subtitled television and films is becoming more normalized than ever, which is lovely. But it does mean that there's also this new appreciation for just how important good subtitles are, for your ability to actually enjoy the thing that you're watching. We want to be transported to Mexico or China or wherever it is, but it's quite hard to do that if what you're reading on the screen is total junk. The biggest controversy in recent weeks has been around Squid Game. Have you watched that, Dominic?
No, I've resisted. I think it's too violent for my delicate constitution.
Mine too. I watched episode one and then read the Wikipedia page, so I didn't have to watch the rest. But there have been loads of bilingual people complaining that a bunch of the nuance has been lost in the English subtitles and the French subtitles and other languages that have been translated from Korean. I was also reading this really interesting Twitter thread, which I'll post in the show notes, about this Turkish show called The Club. So in this one, it's not really the subtitles themselves that pose the problem, but the fact that you can't tell reading them when people are switching language between Turkish and Greek, which is a really big problem for understanding the plot.
Not ideal.
And all of this stuff in general got us thinking about the art form that is subtitle writing. I say art form for a reason. Max Deryagin is a Russian translator and subtitler who campaigns for subtitling to get the recognition it deserves as an art form. He has written the Russian subtitles for a bunch of things, including Orange is the New Black. He is the chair of SUTTLE, the Subtitling Association. And generally, he is a fascinating person to talk to. We gave him a call in Perm in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of talk about bad subtitles recently, but I'd really like to flip things around and be a bit more positive. What makes the subtitles for a film or for a TV show really great? Like, how do you know when the job has been done really, really well?
They need to be synchronized with the audio and segmented at natural pauses. So they need to follow the rhythm of the editing of a film. They also need to be displayed on the screen long enough that the viewer is able to read them before they disappear. They also need to be accurate translations, because sometimes you can read a subtitle file and it's not accurate at all and it ruins everything. So the jokes should land, they should be funny. If there is some subtext to a rather complex symbolic film, that needs to be rendered in a way that kind of conveys that idea in the target language. Well, there's the terminology that you need to make sure is correct. What else? I'm probably forgetting something. But you get the idea.
I imagine that one of the hardest things in your job might be translating specific local cultural references. How do you deal with these tricky and sometimes untranslatable things?
Well, sometimes today they are actually translatable, because back in the day we were kind of further apart as cultures and countries. But today, thanks to the internet, we have these shared things. We understand like internet memes and whatnot. And so, for example, the word cringe, you can leave it as is in Russian. The younger people know what it means. But some other things indeed, we have some things that literally do not exist, for instance, in the United States. And then every single time, it's just a big puzzle. There's no one way to approach this. Every single time is just something new. You have to improvise, you have to be creative, and just make sure that it somehow lands and doesn't seem weird or out of place by the target audience.
So more and more people around the world are watching subtitled films and TV because of Netflix as one big factor. How has Netflix changed your industry?
Oh, it's a very, very complex and multi-layered question, because Netflix have changed a lot, both in good and bad ways. As far as good ways, when they came about, the rates that they set were actually pretty decent, quite a bit above the average in the market. But they have created their own workflow, which involves a lot more stuff that you need to do compared to the traditional workflows. And that means that you just literally have to do more work for the same amount of money. Just to give you an example. So back in the day, a client would give you a subtitle file to proofread. And then that's all they asked from you. That they give you the file, you just fix the errors in it, and then you give it to them. And that's it. But today, it's all QC, which is short for quality control, which means that you not only need to fix the errors, but also assign error types to them. What is it? Punctuation error, translation error, formatting error, or something like that. Plus, you need in some cases to add the severity level, whether it's just a typo or some really serious stuff, and explain your choice in a comment. Now imagine how much more work that is compared to the traditional approach, and yet we are not paid more. And so that has been a problem. But still, I think as a community of translators, we are really, in a way, thankful to Netflix as pretty much the only streaming giant willing to have any sort of conversation with the community. Because the other ones, Amazon Video, Disney Plus, HBO, and so on, they don't have that at all.
Are any of the streaming giants trying to cut corners and use artificial intelligence to do subtitling yet? I mean, everything you've said so far suggests to me that humans are going to be necessary for this job for quite a long time, but I wanted to hear if anyone's actually trying.
The streaming giants don't try themselves anything. What they do is they outsource translation to so-called LSPs, which is short for language service provider, or put simpler, just a translation agency. So they give their stuff to translation agencies and then they manage everything. And the agencies themselves, of course, especially the big ones, want to use AI, particularly machine translation. And they kind of over-exaggerate the quality that we get from them. And that is a huge problem, because then they say, hey, now you don't have to translate yourself. You can just post-edit machine translation quickly. And so it's easier and faster. And because of that, we're going to reduce your rate for post-editing. You know, it's faster. You can make the same amount of money per hour of work. While the reality is the quality is nowhere near as good as they say. And so not only do you end up getting less money, you have to work more. And just the job itself is not as satisfying or fulfilling. Matter of fact, it's kind of even bad for you psychologically. I mean, many people already feel burnt out. And when you get this on top of that, it becomes even worse. Just our mental health doesn't seem to be a priority for translation companies at all.
I've read that these companies also use this thing called pivot translating, where, say, for example, I don't know, there's not many professional subtitlers who speak more obscure combinations of languages, like, for example, Portuguese to Korean translators. So they do this thing where they translate into English and then like the Korean translator will work off the English version. I don't know if there's a better solution, but presumably a lot of nuance must get lost if you do that double translation.
No doubt, because from one point of view, it's kind of inevitable, right? Because where are you going to find professional Indonesian to Russian subtitler? But on the other hand, so much nuance is lost because translation isn't about just the words. You also need to be fluent in the culture of the source country. And it's a big part of our work. And if you're not, if you're translating from an English pivot template, which was created for a French film, or a Portuguese film, and you don't know much about those countries, all that nuance is lost. I can give you an example from the Korean show that I worked on, where the body language is different. The way they use intonation is different. And all that is meaningful. And if you don't see it, it's lost again. Many translators are against pivot templates. Some other understand that it's inevitable. But the talent crunch in the profession that there are not enough subtitlers, we believe is created by these translation agencies. They are to blame for the lack of the translators in these language combinations that are less common.
In what way are they to blame? What are they doing to stop there being more translators?
They're not doing anything actively, but what they're doing is they have created this situation where our profession is simply not lucrative or interesting to people outside of just being so passionate about cinema that you just feel compelled to do it. Financially, subtitling is one of the lowest paid translation fields. What that means is people just do not really feel like starting to do this. By decreasing the rates year after year after year, and by making the working conditions so much tougher, they alienate people from enrolling to universities and doing audiovisual translation courses, from even considering this as a possibility in terms of their career choice. So we could have had many more people if the rates were better and the working conditions were better. And that's the problem.
So you are campaigning for subtitling to be recognized as an art form. What would that recognition look like? Is it just about fair rates or is it more than that?
Fair rates, definitely. More visibility, maybe even just crediting the translator at the end of the film, which sometimes happens, but not always. Also, there is this thing called author's rights, and part of it is getting remunerated as an author. In some countries, as a subtitler, you get royalties for your translations, but those are just a handful. The rest, no. In some countries like Croatia, you are not even considered an author at all as a translator of any sort, not necessarily only subtitler. And that's also part of it. But generally, more visibility, more respect, more understanding that, hey, the film you're watching, that it's translated, it was translated by someone. Because viewers don't really think about it ever.
Before we let you go, Max, I wanted to ask you, what's been your favorite subtitling experience so far?
Oh, that's a difficult one. Oh, probably proofreading the subtitle file for a short film by David Lynch called What Did Jack Do?, which I had to watch more than a dozen of times to make sense of it.
Wow.
So what I found is that it seems that it's like a puzzle of a film where you have to really connect the dots and really, really think of the dialogue, what it means, not only literally, but also figuratively. Take a good look at the visual cues, at the sound cues, and then connect all those pieces to try and make sense. And only then can you translate the film in a way that the target viewer in your country could have access to these puzzle pieces and connect them for themselves. To give you an example, one of the dialogue lines is that someone saw a red rabbit in a dream. And so, okay, as a viewer, you either think that it doesn't mean anything, like most people did, But if you're inquisitive, you will think, well, what does that mean? You go on Google, you type it, and what you find is that it means that a woman in your life is in danger, which makes sense in the film itself. And so it's a piece of a puzzle. But in my language, in Russian, if you translate it literally as red rabbit in a dream, we don't have that in Russia. In Russia, red rabbit in a dream doesn't mean anything. We have white, we have gray rabbit, black rabbit, but not a red one. And so you have to find something in a dream that is as close as possible. And what I managed to find was dead hare, H-A-R-E, which is not quite the same, but, you know, close enough. Like, you cannot translate literally. We have to go that far in terms of research, in terms of understanding the film, its visual storytelling, and then do some research online to find a good approximation. That was so fun, in fact, that I could barely sleep.
I have such a huge respect for what Max does, especially after writing the English subtitles recently for a friend's short film in French. It was just really, really hard to write good sentences that fit on the screen in the amount of time that people had to read them. It's really hard.
Yeah, and you really do need to know a lot about the film in order to understand how to translate all the cultural references. I was watching Drag Race UK over the weekend with the English subtitles turned on because I was watching it with some Dutch friends. And I could just tell that the subtitler didn't get all the British references, all the queer references, all the drag references. And they just like made up words to replace what people were saying. And yeah, that's really disappointing and ruins the experience.
Anyway, speaking of subtitled shows, it's time for Isolation Inspiration. Have you been watching any good subtitled content recently?
Yes, actually. My recommendation today is subtitled. I've got a political recommendation this week, so sorry if you were hoping for something a bit more arty, but it's really good and important. I finally got around to watching this interview that the BBC's Steve Rosenberg did with the authoritarian leader who's currently in charge of Belarus after stealing an election, Alexander Lukashenko. Mm. When someone like Lukashenko is interviewed by a mainstream organisation like the BBC, there's often quite a bit of pushback about giving airtime to someone so despotic. But in this case, I think it might have backfired on Lukashenko. Steve Rosenberg did a really impressive job at conducting this interview and, yeah, responding to some really bizarre claims from Lukashenko. I also found it really interesting to listen then to Rosenberg on the BBC's Media Show podcast, talking about how he secured this interview and how it was for him going into the presidential palace and conducting a very challenging conversation in Russian despite not being a native speaker. I highly recommend you watch the original interview and also listen to Steve talking about it afterwards. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I watched Lords of Scam on Netflix. Netflix again. We used to be very good at recommending a more diverse range of televisual sources, but there's just so much good European stuff on there. Anyway, Lords of Scam. I think a lot of you will like it. It is a documentary about EU carbon tax fraud, which sounds incredibly boring. But the central character is this deeply roguish character who just happens to be from my own neighborhood in Paris. The whole cast of characters just feel cartoonish in their like sort of gangsteriness. It's really quite an engaging watch. It has got EU-wide fraud. It's got environmental policies gone wrong. It has got roguish characters. Lords of Scam on Netflix. It is in French. I haven't actually watched it with the subtitles. So people can watch it with subtitles and let me know if they're any good.
I have a happy ending this week from Romania, where yesterday, for the first time in the country's history, they released a new banknote with the face of a woman on it instead of a man.
Well done, Romania. 2021, there's a woman on the banknote. Is it any woman in particular?
It is a woman in particular, yes. It's a woman called Ekaterina Teodoriu, a First World War veteran who was the first woman to serve in the Romanian army. She was originally working as a nurse during the war, but after her brother sadly died in an artillery attack, she wanted to avenge her brother's death and help by fighting. She's long been a national hero in Romania and has even been described as the Joan of Arc of Romania. And she's now on the 20 lei banknote, a note that's worth about €4. Anyway, here's to more non-men on banknotes.
Banknotes aside, I hope that all of our chatting about subtitles has inspired you to go and watch some more international TV and movies this week. Feels fitting, since the continent is increasingly cancelling other forms of fun at the moment. So until next week, you will probably find us parked in front of Netflix, mostly, but also on social media. Whereabouts, Domi?
You can find us on Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram at EuropeansPodcast, Facebook, The Europeans Podcast. That's it.
There's also our website. We always forget about that old thing. It's a very nice website. EuropeansPodcast.com.
This episode was produced by my wonderful co-host, Katie Lee, and our producer, Wojciech Oleksiak. Our senior producer, Katz Laszlo, is off working on some very exciting other episodes right now that you can look forward to in the new year. This podcast is part of the Are We Europe audio family. Go and check out their entire podcast selection in the link in the show notes. We'll be back next week.
Stay safe, everyone.
Yeah, do that.
Пока.
Bye.